hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The Great Salt Lake, America's largest natural lake west of the Mississippi River, has reached its lowest levels in recorded history. Officials and lawmakers in Utah say the state needs to take serious measures to prevent further drops in lake levels. The current state of the Great Salt Lake follows severe dry conditions affecting Utah and other western states. Water has also been taken from the lake to supply homes and crops in Utah, one of the nation's fastest-growing states. Utah is also one of the driest American states, but has high water usage rates. The severe drop in lake levels has raised concerns in the state about harmful dust, environmental damage, and economic problems. Further water loss is expected to present serious risks to millions of migrating birds. It could also hurt a lake-based economy estimated to be worth $1.3 billion. Economic activities include the production of minerals and brine shrimp and recreation. Health experts also fear that a dry lake bed could send poisonous dust into the air that millions of people breathe. Utah Governor Spencer Cox has proposed spending $46 million to help solve the Great Salt Lake problems. Top lawmakers have also supported major spending to improve lake conditions. One proposal would seek to restrict water use in homes and businesses. Another would pay farmers for sharing their water. A third would direct money from mineral production activities to programs aimed at improving the lake. I long took for granted the lake. It's always been there, and I've assumed it always would be there, House Speaker Brad Wilson told a special meeting held to discuss the issue. But learning about the lake's worsening position over the summer left him afraid. "The Great Salt Lake is in trouble. We have to do something," Wilson said. Zach Frankel is director of the nonprofit Utah Rivers Council. He told the Associated Press he thinks major action is needed in order to save the Great Salt Lake. "It's not going to do it with baby steps. These are tiny baby steps that should have been taken 20 years ago," Frankel said. The lower lake levels have led to reductions in underwater structures that contain microorganisms that brine shrimp depend on for food. The shrimp support a multi-million dollar industry that supplies food for fish farms. It also provides nutrients to millions of migrating birds that can show up on radar. The Great Salt Lake is also the nation's biggest source of magnesium and could soon provide lithium, a key mineral for making batteries. But last year, the lake matched a 170-year record low and kept dropping. It hit a new low of 1,277.2 meters in October. As a result, a large amount of the microorganisms necessary for the health of brine shrimp were damaged by air. The die-off will likely take years to repair, even if they are fully covered with water again, said Michael Vandenberg. He is a Utah State geologist. If the water levels continue to drop, the lake could get too salty for the microorganisms to survive. This has already happened in the bright pink waters of the lake's northern arm. I'm Brian Lynn.
Imagine a town clock that shows not the minutes and seconds that control our lives, but time that moves faster or slower based on how fast rivers are running. The Chattahoochee River and some smaller bodies of water flow through the city of Atlanta, Georgia. Most of the people in the city do not think much about the river. Jonathan Keats wants to change that. The San Francisco-based artist is on an extended stay in Georgia. He has been working there to help people become more involved with their natural environment. Keats is called a conceptual artist, that is, he works with ideas rather than creating physical works of art. His latest concept, Atlanta River Time, would have volunteers go down to waterways and take measurements. The information they collect, with help from conservation groups and U.S. Geological Survey data, would tell time in a very different way. The natural flow of Georgia's waterways would be shown on a large city clock in downtown Atlanta. Ideally, people will get into the water to observe and to consider the effects of the flow of water on the world, as well as the causes of that flow, Keats told the Associated Press. He wants people to think not only about time, but about how we live in the world. Keats has led classes since the fall of 2021 to teach people how to use handmade materials to record flow rates. To bring his idea into reality, he hopes to build a mechanical clock that uses a pendulum. A pendulum is a stick with a weight on one end that moves back and forth regularly to keep time. Every year, people would travel to the source of the Chattahoochee River and measure the water flow. They would change the movement of the pendulum based on the water's movement. Why use waterways when we have clocks, smartphones, computers, and watches telling us the time already? Keats says he does not use a mobile phone, but he has thought a lot about such questions while walking along Georgia's red clay riverbanks. All of this is a story that we can tell, and a story allows us to reflect on ourselves as a result of that path that we take, Keats said. The artist's earlier art projects included selling imaginary lands and opening a restaurant that serves special sunlight to plants. He put a millennium camera in a tall building at Amherst College that he said would record climate change through a 1,000-year photograph of a mountain range. I'm Jill Robbins.
The Winter Olympic Games are currently taking place in Beijing, China. In celebration of the event, we will explore a couple areas of connection between the Olympic Games and grammar. You will learn how subjects such as ordinal numbers and sentence fragments help describe the events and results of the competitions. When you first learn numbers in English, you generally start with numbers such as 1, 2, 3. These are known as cardinal numbers. But in the Olympic Games, ordinal numbers are of central importance. Ordinal numbers suggest an order of things. Think the order of winners in the Olympics. The three most important ordinal numbers in the Olympics are first, second, and third. In other words, gold, silver, and bronze. Ordinal numbers can act as nouns, adjectives, or adverbs. And when we talk about the Olympics, we use ordinal numbers for all of these purposes. Let's explore the noun form first. Imagine you hear two English speakers discussing the Olympic Games. One might ask, "When do the Olympics start?" The second person might say, "They start on the 3rd," or "They start on the 2nd. In both cases, the ordinal number is acting like a noun. It means the order of the day in the month. You can tell the number is acting like a noun because of the word "the" in front of it. In English, words such as "the" are markers of nouns. Ordinal numbers also can act as adverbs. In discussions before, during, and after the Olympics, you might hear a person say, "That team ranked 3rd in the world last year." In this case, the word "third" gives more information about the past tense verb, ranked. You might also hear ordinal numbers used to modify adjectives, as in "second largest team" or "third winningest team." Here is an example of this idea during the opening ceremony. The broadcaster describes the second largest delegation.
Second largest winter delegation in Team U.S. history.
Finally, you might also hear ordinal numbers used as an adjective. In this video, the broadcaster says "first gold medal" and "second time Sweden have won the gold."
And she wins Sweden's first gold medal. The second time that Sweden have won the gold.
Ordinal numbers are one important area of grammar that connects with the Olympics. But another area of connection is expressions of surprise with what. In many cases, these expressions take the form of a sentence fragment. A fragment is a kind of sentence that is not complete. A complete sentence has a subject and predicate that consists of a verb, objects, and so on. An example of a complete sentence is this: "I love the Olympic Games." The subject is "I." The predicate is "love the Olympic Games." Sentence fragments leave out one of these parts, either the subject or the predicate. Fragments are common in everyday speaking, speeches, and news broadcasts about sports, among other situations. In the Olympics, these fragments often take the form of expressions of surprise during and after events. In the following video, the broadcaster says, "What a hectic and unexpected result."
Wow, what a hectic and unexpected result.
In this case, the statement does not have a verb. It begins with "what" and continues with a noun phrase: "A hectic and unexpected result." You will hear all kinds of these statements during broadcasts of the Olympic Games. For example, you might hear a person say, "What a race!" or "What a beautiful finish!" or "What a finish!" The central idea in today's report was to explore an area of connection between an event, the Olympics, and an area of grammar. When you watch the Olympics, whether on live television or online, pay careful attention to how speakers use ordinal numbers and expressions of surprise. Make careful note of what you hear. Then, practice using the structures. You can also take any other event, celebration, or activity, and think of the areas of grammar that connect to it. Doing so will not only help your understanding of grammar, but also make your studies more enjoyable. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The early years of the 20th century were a time of movement for many black Americans. Traditionally, most blacks lived in the southeastern states. But in the 1920s, many blacks moved to cities in the north. Black Americans moved because living conditions were so poor in the rural areas of the southeast. But many of them discovered that life was also hard in the colder northern cities. Jobs often were hard to find, housing was poor, and whites sometimes acted violently against them. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell about the life of black Americans in the 1920s and how they helped form traditions.
The years just before and after 1920 were difficult for blacks. It was a time of racial hatred. Many whites joined the Ku Klux Klan organization. The Klan often terrorized blacks. Klan members sometimes burned fiery crosses in front of the houses of black families, and they sometimes beat and murdered blacks. The Ku Klux Klan also acted against Roman Catholics, Jews, and foreigners, but it hated blacks most of all.
The United States also suffered a series of race riots in a number of cities during this period. White and black Americans fought each other in Omaha, Philadelphia, and other cities. The worst riot was in Chicago. A swimming incident started the violence. A black boy sailing a small boat entered a part of the beach used by white swimmers. Some white persons threw stones at the boy. He fell into the water and drowned. Black citizens heard about the incident and became extremely angry. Soon, black and white mobs were fighting each other in the streets. The violence lasted for 2 weeks. 38 persons died. More than 500 were wounded. The homes of hundreds of families were burned. The violence in Chicago and other cities did not stop black Americans from moving north or west. They felt that life had to be better than in the South.
Black Americans left the South because life was hard, economic chances few, and white hatred common. But many blacks arrived in other parts of the country only to learn that life was no easier. some blacks wrote later that they had only traded the open racism of the rural Southeast for the more secret racism of northern cities. Blacks responded to these conditions in different ways. Some blacks followed the ideas of Booker T. Washington, the popular black leader of the early 1900s. Washington believed that blacks had to educate and prepare themselves to survive in American society. He helped form a number of training schools where blacks could learn skills for better jobs, and he urged blacks to establish businesses and improve themselves without causing trouble with whites. Other blacks liked the stronger ideas of William Du Bois. Du Bois felt that blacks had to take firm actions to protest murders and other illegal actions. He published a magazine and spoke actively for new laws and policies to protect black rights. Du Bois also helped form a group that later became the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The NAACP became one of the nation's leading black rights organizations in the 20th century.
Probably the most important leader for black Americans in the 1920s did not come from the United States. He was Marcus Garvey from the Caribbean island of Jamaica. Garvey moved to New York City in 1916. He quickly began organizing groups in black areas. His message was simple. He said blacks should not trust whites. Instead, they should be proud of being black and should help each other. Garvey urged blacks to leave the United States, move to Africa, and start their own nation. Marcus Garvey organized several plans to help blacks become economically independent of whites. His biggest effort was a shipping company to trade goods among black people all over the world. Many American blacks gave small amounts of money each week to help Garvey start the shipping company. However, the idea failed. Government officials arrested Garvey for collecting the money unlawfully. They sent him to prison in 1925. And 2 years later, President Coolidge ordered Garvey out of the country. Marcus Garvey's group was the first major black organization in the United States to gain active support from a large number of people. The organization failed, but it did show the anger and lack of hope that many blacks felt about their place in American society.
Blacks also showed their feelings through writing, art, and music. The 1920s were one of the most imaginative periods in the history of American black art. Claude McKay, Langston Hughes, and County Cullen were three of the leading black poets during this time. McKay was best known for his poems of social protest. Hughes produced poems about black life that experts now say are among the greatest American poems ever written. Black writers also produced longer works. among the leading black novelists were Jesse Fawcett, Jean Toomer, and Rudolph Fisher.
The 1920s also were an exciting time for black music. Black musicians playing the piano developed the ragtime style of music. Singers and musicians produced a sad, emotional style of playing that became known as the blues. And most important, music lovers began to play and enjoy a new style that was becoming known as jazz. Jazz advanced greatly as a true American kind of music in the 1920s. Musicians Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and UB Blake played in gathering places and small theaters. White musicians and music experts from universities came to listen. Soon, the music became popular among Americans of all kinds and around the world.
Blacks began to recognize in the 1920s their own deep roots in the United States. They began to see just how much black men and women already had done to help form American history and traditions. The person who did the most to help blacks understand this was black historian Carter G. Woodson. Woodson received his training at two leading universities, Harvard in Massachusetts and the Sorbonne in France. He launched a new publication, the Journal of Negro History, in which he and other experts wrote about black life and history. Historians today call Woodson the father of the scientific study of black history.
The 1920s also were a period in which a number of blacks experimented with new political ideas and parties. The difficult social conditions of the period led many blacks to search for new political solutions. Two leftist parties, the Socialists and the Communists, urged blacks to leave the traditional political system and work for more extreme change. Two leading black socialists, Chandler Owen and A. Philip Randolph, urged blacks to support socialist candidates. However, they gained little popular support from blacks. Communists also tried to organize black workers, but generally, black voters showed little interest in communist ideas. The most important change in black political thinking during the 1920s came within the traditional two-party system itself. Blacks usually had voted for Republicans since the days of Abraham Lincoln. But the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s caused many blacks to become Democrats. By 1932, blacks would vote by a large majority for the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Roosevelt, and blacks continue to be a major force in the Democratic Party.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.